Welcome to the CBWC Theology for the Ordinary podcast on the Book of Revelation. I'm Cindy Emmons, and together with Mark Dirksen, we will host Ed Neufeld as he speaks about the Book of Revelation. Dr. Ed Neufeld is the pastor of Kleefeld Christian Community and adjunct professor of biblical studies at Providence Theological Seminary. Ed loves to study the Bible and to help others understand it, and we look forward to him sharing his insights about the somewhat intimidating Book of Revelation with us.
The format of the podcast will basically go this way. We'll let Ed do most of the talking, and at the end of each session, there will be some questions and answers. Some weeks we'll cover only one chapter, and other weeks we'll cover more material. We will release one episode every week.
You're listening to Episode 1 on Revelation Chapter 1.
My first year of teaching in seminary, I got there. I did not know what the teaching load would be that first fall, so I showed up. My job started, I think, at the beginning of August, and I found out at that time I was scheduled to teach Revelation that fall. And I was green as grass. I had just finished doctoral studies, so everything about that job terrified me. But if one thing could have made it worse, it would have been teaching Revelation. I don't think there was a book in the New Testament I was so little qualified to do anything with. When I was in high school or junior high, mid-teens somewhere, my pastor at my home church did a Sunday evening series on the Book of Revelation. He had a big chart across the whole front of the church, the platform, and it stayed up for all services for those, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. It felt like a very long series. And it was an elaborate chart. It was the normal dispensational approach. And that's all I knew about Revelation. And I went after that eventually to a Bible school and then a Bible college and then a seminary. And I took courses also in doctoral school. And at no point in any of that did I take a course on Revelation. I don't remember avoiding it. I don't even remember it being offered. There was enough of the end times movies and Hal Lindsey's book and so on. We mostly just avoided Revelation. And now I'm supposed to teach it. So that first week in August, I think I read right through Revelation probably 2 or 3 times, maybe 3 times. Could read through Revelation in a couple hours if you sit, and I did things like that in those days, and I read through it about 3 times, and I was baffled by this book. But the one thing I knew for sure is that if I had not seen the chart, it would never occur to me to understand the Book of Revelation that way. I just would never have gotten, I couldn't see anything in there when you read it that way, that would confirm the chart. So I just threw it out and I started all over again. And I went to another teacher who had been around longer, and I said, can you point me to a commentary on Revelation that just sort of goes through and takes it as it comes to make sense of it? And yeah, he had gave me a commentary. It was Beasley Murray, the New Century Bible series. So it was written in the 70s. It's not a very long, but they all have basically the same approach, but it was all brand new to me. So that was the start. And I really enjoyed teaching that course, and it was an eye opener right through. So I have taught it, preached it a few times since then. On Revelation chapter one, the session is on Revelation chapter one. And there are 4 or 5 points I want to make. I think the first two are most important. So I'm going to read right from Revelation, chapter 1, verse 3. Revelation, chapter 1, verse 3. Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it and keep what is written in it, because the time is near. The NIV has there those who take to heart what is written in it, because the time is near. But it's the word, it's a standard word in Greek, the word keep, and it is used several other times in Revelation, and the NIV translates all of those keep as well. So I don't know why this one is take to heart. But Let's go through that sentence. Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it and keep what is written in it, because the time is near. So somebody was sent by John to go around those seven churches, and there was a blessing for them. And then for the people on the churches, there's a blessing for those who hear it and keep what is written in it. Keep the prophecy is kind of an odd phrase. We would keep commands, perhaps, or keep instructions, but keep the prophecy is a little bit unusual. Some translations actually translate it obey here. But that's really the point here, is that this prophecy is given to obey. There is something here to keep, something we're supposed to do. If you look, and Revelation ends the same way, if you look in chapter 22, verse 7 says, blessed is the one who keeps the word of the prophecy written in this scroll. And in verse 9, the angel says to John, I'm a fellow servant with you and your fellow prophets and all who keep the words of this scroll, worship God. So this is a really simple point. Revelation is a book to be obeyed. It's not a mystery to get unraveled. It's a call to obey. And we could understand every single mysterious line in this whole book. And if we did not hear in this a clear call from God about how we're going to live, and if we don't hear it and we don't obey it, the book is wasted. We actually don't know anything about it, because it is not effective until it's guiding our lives. It is a book to shape us. And if you think about the Old Testament prophets, all prophecy was like this. I have taught quite a few of the prophets and preached through more. I'm probably most familiar with Jeremiah and Amos, but they're all like this. Jeremiah, the prophecy of Jeremiah, is a call to the Jews in his day about how they're supposed to live. You're doing this stuff that's wrong. You need to stop that. And here's how God wants you to live. Here's why God's upset with you, and this is the way you ought to live. And so there's no ambiguity reading through Jeremiah what it is those people are supposed to do. So there's prophecy in there. If you don't do this, the Babylonians are going to come. But the point of the prophet was not to predict the Babylonians. It was to warn the ungodly and encourage the faithful. And Amos is in a different setting. He's talking to the northern kingdom a little bit earlier, but it's the same thing. Most of Amos is, this is what you're doing that God doesn't want, and this is what he wants. And if you don't alter your life, there's going to be judgment. So a prophecy is always in scripture, mostly not about the future. It is a call to obey. It's important that we see Revelation that way. And what we want to do is to covet that blessing. Okay? What we want that blessing. Blessed are those who hear it and keep what is written in it. Blessed are those who hear it and obey it. So that's what we're after here. And as long as we're aiming that way, then the book is doing the right thing. The second important thing to establish about the book of Revelation is to whom it was written. This is mentioned twice. Chapter 1, verse 4, John to the seven churches in the province of Asia. A revelation is a prophecy, and it's also a letter. It's a number of things going on at once. It is an actual revelation. He's describing a revelation. It is a prophecy, and it is a letter. So, John to the seven churches in the province of Asia. I want you to see how similar this is, for example, to the opening of Galatia, which is Paul to the churches in Galatia. And other times it talks about there will be the churches of Judea or the church in Jerusalem. So a real simple point that we understand the whole book was written to those seven churches. They are listed again. The whole thing comes again in verse 11. The loud voice says, chapter 1, verse 11, write on a scroll what you see and send it to the seven churches, Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. So John's on the island of Patmos, and if you look at a map of the sea there and of that province called Asia Minor, the closest port city to the island of Patmos, and it's not very far, is Ephesus. And if you would look on a map and go from Ephesus to Smyrna to Pergamum to Thyatira, it's a loop. You start off, Smyrna is farther up the coast, you would go a little north, and then it goes inland, and basically those seven cities give you three quarters of a circle, something like that. The point is, it is a very natural route for a messenger to take. So John's on the island and he's exiled, which means if we see you on the mainland, you're a dead man. If you want to stay alive, stay on that island. So John writes this letter and he gives it to someone who will sail across to Ephesus and then go to each one of those seven churches and read it. But it is set up geographically to work, and the seven are always named in the same order. That's the order in which they were read. The book of Revelation was written to seven churches in the first century who were about to face a severe time of persecution. In fact, in some cases, it seems have already started. It was imminent. If it had not begun, it would begin within a year or two, and in some places it seems already have begun. But the point is, the whole book was written to those churches. And the whole thing needs to make sense in however it would make sense to the first century churches. So any kind of interpretation of locusts with scorpion tails or whatever we're going to do, if it does not make sense in the first century, we don't need that, because it was to help them through their trouble. What I'm urging here is the same thing we do with every other writing in the Bible. So I mentioned Jeremiah and Amos. So those messages are preached to those people at that time, but it's written down because all of God's people can learn from this. And when we read the letter to the Galatians or to the Corinthians, we assume that those churches at that time needed that, what's going on. But the Spirit speaks for all time. And so we read those things and benefit from it. So I urge that we take Revelation in the very same way. There is nothing to suggest that it's not meant there. And what that means is that when we start with the seals in chapter 6, we don't assume that now John is talking about something that is going to start in 2,000 years. Those people were in trouble. They're trying to make sense of their world. And if the seals do not help them understand their world and their spiritual conflict, this whole thing is a waste. It's really a miserable joke is what it is. Because now I'm going to give you this writing that's going to help you in your troubles now, and most of it won't have any relevance for at least 2,000 years. Like, that's ugly. So that's not what's going on. It is, and we'll talk about that in these subsequent points. So all of this needs to make sense in the first century, and there was most certainly a beast in the first century, and there was a great prostitute in the first century, and they knew what it was. So this whole thing helps them navigate their difficult lives. And we need to understand that those seven churches need a lot of help making sense of what's going on in their lives. And this is written to them. It's a revelation to them and for them, so that they will know how to live in those very hard times. That's basically what's going on right through this whole letter. So there are obviously things in Revelation that are not fulfilled. It talks about the return of the Lord and the new heaven and the new earth. So that hasn't happened yet. And there's some kind of a final battle that hasn't happened yet. But, you know, 1 Corinthians talks about the resurrection and the return of Christ, and that hasn't happened yet, too. So that doesn't mean it was not for the people in Corinth at that time. So in the same way, Revelation is written for those people at that time to help them make sense of what's going on in their lives. So we can grab those two things, that it is, there's a blessing to those who obey what is written, and that the initial whole letter, the whole book have made sense to those seven churches, then we are well on our way here. Revelation 1 and Daniel. Daniel 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. He dreams about a big statue, and there's different metals, gold, and then there's a torso of bronze and legs of iron, and then feet are a mix of iron and clay. And he wants to know what's going on there. And so in the interpretation of the vision, Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians are the first kingdom, the golden head. And then there will be three more kingdoms. And in the dream, a rock comes out of nowhere, a rock not made by human hands, and it lands on the feet of this thing. And eventually the whole thing crumbles. The whole statue crumbles and is blown away by the wind. And the rock grows to become a mountain and takes over the whole earth. That's Daniel chapter 2. In something similar happens in Daniel chapter 7. There, instead of one statue with four different metals involved, there are beasts that come out of the sea. That's certainly something Revelation likes. And so three different beasts come out of the sea, and then a fourth beast comes. And the fourth beast is particularly obnoxious and blasphemous. And then all of a sudden we cut to the Ancient of Days, God taking his throne, and the one like a son of man approaches God and is given all authority, and he's given an everlasting kingdom. And in Daniel, so the four kingdoms don't quite line up the same in chapter 2 as in chapter 4, but the basic plot is the same. And what Revelation 1 is telling us that the time, for example, when that rock has struck the feet of the statue, that's happened. Christ is the rock. In Mark 1, Jesus says, the time is fulfilled, the kingdom of God has arrived. And so Revelation 1 is signaling to the readers of Daniel that we are now in that final stage where the rock has actually landed on earth and the Son of Man has actually received authority and his kingdom. That's where we are. And so Revelation 1 says, the revelation from Jesus Christ. And now the word revelation in Greek is apocalypse. And Daniel is just full of that word, apocalypse. So that's where he's quoting that, and to show his servants what must soon take place. So in Greek, it reads what must happen in the last days, or what must happen after these things. That's what it says in Matthew. But now it's soon. It's going to happen right now. So the intervening centuries are over, and Revelation is saying that thing in Daniel is well into the future. Now it's here. So in simple terms, the last days started with the first coming of Christ. That's what Revelation is trying to say. The last days started with the first coming of Christ. And so there are a number of hints to Daniel 2, the last part of Daniel 2, in the specific wording, the things that must happen, and chapter 1, verse 19, what you've seen and what will take place. That's all echoing Daniel 2. And the second half of Revelation, we see the one like a son of man, and he is obviously the ruling king. He's a divine figure. So there's a strong sense in Revelation 1 that what Daniel looked forward to. Daniel's writing 600 years earlier. What he's looking forward to when the rock strikes the statue and when the Son of Man receives authority, that is now happening, and we are at that point. The time is fulfilled, and we're moving on. So he's helping them put this in perspective, because the message of Daniel is actually a lot like the message of Revelation. There's going to be huge pressure to worship idols. That's basically what's going on. There's going to be huge pressure to worship idols, and human powers are going to be evil, and they are going to seem overwhelming. Endure to the end. Don't deny the Lord, and don't worship an idol. Keep going. That's sort of the message of Daniel, that God's in control of those kingdoms, and that's what's going on in Revelation as well. He's controlling all these things. Revelation 1 puts us in that sequence in Daniel. We're right near the end there. One more thing about this vision. John has a remarkable vision of Christ. Christ is remarkable in Revelation 1 all the way through. He's the faithful witness, and he is the ruler of the kings of the earth. He made us a kingdom and priests to serve God, and so on. So he's a remarkable figure. He is clearly King of Kings and Lord of Lords in chapter 1. In the vision that John has of Jesus in the last half of chapter 1, he hears a voice that says, a voice like a trumpet, write on a scroll what you see, which is talking about the whole book, and send it to the seven churches. And he turns to see the voice that was speaking to me. And when I turned, I saw seven golden lampstands, and among the lampstands, someone like the Son of Man. So even though the Son of Man is clearly the dominant figure in that vision, the first thing John sees is the lampstands. And the vision ends also with the lampstands. So the lampstands are not peripheral. They're sort of the bracket. They're the basket that carries this. And he tells us at the end that the lampstands are the churches. I want to talk a little bit about how symbols work in Revelation. We sometimes treat the symbols in Revelation like a code. I mentioned later on, it will talk about locusts with tails that sting like scorpions. And we think, okay, we want to know what's the referent, what's the actual reality on earth. And if we could know what the reality on earth was that those things represented, then we feel like we understand Revelation. That's not true. It's helpful to know what the referent is, but the fact that they are locusts and they sting like that, that is the message. And they're the symbol is giving us the spiritual reality. Now, we're going to leave those guys alone. We'll come back to them in due time. Here, the symbol is a lampstand. So lampstand is not just a code word for church. Lampstand is telling us what churches are like. You see, all the way through Revelation, the whole book is giving us the spiritual realities behind the material reality. What's the spiritual dynamic that explains the world we live in? And Revelation is giving that to us all the way through. And so the fact that there is an awful beast, and there is a huge prostitute, and there is a slaughtered lamb, and there is the Lion of Judah, and all of these are telling us about the spiritual world that we live in. And we live with those realities. They all shape earth. And so the symbols, actually, if we look them at that in that way, are quite transparent. They're not hard to figure out. We're just not asking the right question. We're asking what's the referent, and that's not the point. The point is what do they tell us? So lampstands. There was the lampstand comes from Exodus, and in the tabernacle there was a lampstand in the presence of God. There was one lampstand. It was made out of gold, and it was in the tabernacle, and the it had seven little lamps on it, and they were never to go out day and night because there's always light in the presence of God. So the lampstands are in the presence of God, and they are a source of light. And one of the curious things in Exodus 25, where we read about how the lampstands were to be made, is that the lampstands, the emphasis is actually on them being a tree. They are an almond tree that is covered with buds, blossoms, and flowers. So you picture the main stem and every one of the six branches is just full of buds, blossoms, and flowers. So the lampstand is made like a tree that's just bursting into life. The tree is bursting into life as much as you could do from gold. And so it's not just light. So think about this. So we have a tree in Exodus that is bursting into life. Is there anything before that that would remind you of? And it takes us back to the garden, the tree of life. Right in the garden, there was a tree of life. So somehow the lampstand is capturing the fruitfulness of the garden. So a church is a lampstand. So it is in the presence of God, and it is an ongoing source of light. And it is also represents the tree of life. The life of God is there in this lampstand, and it represents the life of God. So all of these things are John telling the churches and telling us what we are. And so all the way through, the symbols are like that. They are all giving us a spiritual reality. And to simply understand that the lampstand represents a church, we have not really begun to understand what John is telling us when he talks about lampstands until we figure out what lampstands are like and how they work. And if Revelation is, to whatever extent it is, a code, the code book is the Old Testament. There's just nothing in there that is not all over the Old Testament. And if we, maybe you have a favorite book of the New Testament, or a few favorite songs. And if we knew the whole Old Testament, as well as we know our favorite book of the New Testament, Revelation would have very few mysteries for us because we know what he's talking about. And so if you studied the temple furniture, if you had done that recently, or if I had done that, then the lampstands make sense. Oh, okay, that's what a church is. So that's the way the symbols operate all the way through this letter. And it's very helpful for us to know what are the spiritual realities. So here, the very nice thing is that the Lord walks around in the middle of the lampstands. He stands in the middle of them. And so this is for those seven churches, but it's for every church. And this Lord is a very impressive figure. He's the kind of person that if you could see him, as it says in verse 17, I fell at his feet as though dead. So I sometimes sit in our church and I imagine this one like the Son of Man walking around in the church. And as a favor to us, we can't see him, but he is certainly there. He walks among the churches, and this remarkable figure is walking among the churches. He's close to him. And he's paying close attention to everything that's going on in their minds. For churches, the vision is very encouraging that they're in a scary time because we're now in the final stage of what Daniel was writing about. On the other hand, our Lord has complete authority. Oh, and one of the things, notice what he says, the first words in verse 17, when I saw him, John says in his vision, I fell at his feet as though dead, and he placed his right hand on me, and he said, do not be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I was dead, and look, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and of Hades. The first thing, the the Son of Man wants to make clear to John and to us in this vision is, I'm in charge of life and death. I'm in charge. Before the Lord, there is never an accidental death. There has never been an accidental death. I hold the keys of death and of Hades. And when I open the door, you're going in. And if I don't open the door, you're not going in. And so in a difficult, painful world, that's just really good to know. And Jesus could have said a lot of things to John at this point, but that is the first thing. And he talks about his own. I've been through death. I'm alive. I was dead, and I'm alive forever. And there's hope in there. And I hold the keys of death and of Hades. And so Christ's complete authority over death is one of the first things that comes through here. And that's a very good thing to know. Those, I think, are the basics that I would like to get across about chapter one, the blessing for those who obey what is written in this prophecy, and that this all begins as John encouraging those seven churches, and they were to understand this as for them, and how symbols work, and that what Revelation is giving us is the spiritual reality that explains the world we live in. It was true then, and it's still true now. Amen. What do you think?
You mentioned at the beginning, about how, you hadn't spent a lot of time in Revelation and so on and so forth. And I suspect that's still true for a lot of pastors and a lot of people who follow Christ, that Revelation isn't necessarily one of the books that we turn to very quickly or very often. And so, I'm wondering, why do you think that aversion has been there for churches, pastors, Christ followers?
A few reasons, perhaps. I think that the way it often gets used has put people off. Most of my students are just not interested. The only thing they know about Revelation is the prophecy shows on television, and they're not interested in that. They can't buy that, and they just know nothing about it, and they're not interested in it. Another thing is that the incredible symbolism is not how we communicate. It's just not how, it's not normal. We like clear that, the Gospels are narrative, Acts is narrative. It just tells a story, you can make sense. And the letters are clearly letters and so on. They are more orderly. And the symbolism here, we're just not used to using our imagination like that. Although the symbolism is all, these are all symbols that are in the Old Testament. He's not making up really anything that's not already in somewhere in the prophets or going right back to Moses. So that's a guess. I think that the language in itself is difficult for us, and that what we have heard did not please us. So why would you go back for more of that? I have heard that when churches are real in persecution, I've heard this from a man from China, that when the church was persecuted, Revelation makes perfect sense. And you're asking different questions about God and about life. And when you're persecuted, you don't need to sort all that other stuff out. You try to sort out. What Revelation is actually saying is pretty clear. And there's a God behind all this, and there are dark forces, and he's taking us through and so on. So the message for persecuted people, if you assume it's written to you, is pretty good. We have not lived like that, but I've heard it works very well in those contexts.
Another question I had was about, referred to a dispensational view at the beginning and how that wasn't working for you. And there's different ways, interpreters have a few different ways of approaching Revelation. So can you describe some of those ways, for instance? And yours would be more of a historical kind of view. You want to talk about that a little bit more?
There's the futuristic view, which is usually dispensational, takes it all as in the future. It hasn't happened yet. The unfairness there is it's really very little good after the end of chapter 3 to those seven churches. That seems improbable. There's an idealist view that has much to commend it, and that it's for all times, and it's not actually about historical events. It's just describing the spiritual life and how it affects human life and life on earth. And so it's giving ideals, and there's much to be commended for that. So the historical view planted solidly in the first century. I don't know that the idealist view is much different than that, but some of them would say that the whole thing is true in the first century, and they would take even the new heaven and the new earth as kind of idealist and not an actual return of Christ. And they would say there was just nothing there that was not applicable in the first century. So most don't go that way very far, but the historical view takes it as landing solidly on those seven churches and all it intended for them, even though it includes some events that still haven't happened. But most of it was to explain the world in which they lived.
Good, thanks. And then I've got another one. You know, you talk about how the understanding of Revelation, it kind of hinges on that the last days started with the first coming of Christ. And so essentially, we're in a times of tribulation as we speak. One of the pieces that commentators talk about in terms of tribulation is that tribulation is not always rooted in the evil one. It is rooted also in the work of God. And so how do we allow our theologies to allow for that? Or what do you think about some of those things?
Revelation doesn't answer that exactly the way that Peter does. I'll go to Peter, though. First Peter is written to a church that's being persecuted, and he's not very optimistic about the world in which they live. And he tells them to live faithfully and to endure, and that the Lord is going to return. But then in chapter 5, he says, don't be surprised at this fiery trial that you're in. These things are going to happen. And then near the end, he says, submit yourselves under the mighty hand of God. Humble yourselves under God. And don't fight this so hard. If this is what he's bringing on the church, what's going to happen to the rest of the people? So in the final analysis, he puts it back on God. Revelation does not take it quite that far. Although when it talks about the beast, he was given authority and he was given a certain amount of time. And there's no, he's on a leash and God holds the leash. And he's on a time limit. He's on a timer. And he's on a length. You can go this far and no farther. And it was given to him to conquer the saints, to make war with the saints and conquer them. It's a horrible lie. But the point is that this is being permitted by God. This authority has been given to him temporarily by God. It's being allowed there. One of the scandalous things about the Bible, is I'm thinking particularly about Psalms and about the book of Job. Naomi does this in the end of Ruth 1. When bad stuff happens, the scriptures hold God ultimately responsible and go to him and say, why are you doing this? And we're squeamish about that. We're not supposed to talk to God like that. I remember reading Job as a young man and thinking, wow, we're allowed to talk like that to God? We could say stuff like that to God? And he's a model of patience and endurance and great faith. And I think, wow, it just opened up a whole other world. So it's pretty raw there. And the scripture does not sort that out. There's real evil going on. And somehow God is working and has his plans. And that's, I can't take it any farther than that. But it's certainly in the mix.
One of the pieces that you talked about at verse 18, I am the living one. I was dead, and now look, that piece there. And then your paraphrase, I'm in charge, I think is a real encouraging word. So thanks for that.
Yeah. That vision in chapter 1 is intended to be encouraged. The whole book is for the faithful and encouragement. I mean, the sealing in chapter 7, that's for them. They're supposed to know that. They're sealed and they're protected. Their souls are protected by God and guarded over. And so on. All of these things are for them to encourage them, and so on. The last stage, I want to say something about tribulation. In verse 9, I, John, your brother and companion in the suffering and kingdom and patient endurance that are ours in Jesus. In Greek, it's the suffering and the kingdom and the tribulation that are ours. This is what we get. Suffering, kingdom, tribulation. Oh, I'm not reading that right. Hang on. The word suffering should be tribulation. The tribulation and the kingdom and the endurance. So my point is that John is already in tribulation. The NIV, I'm not pleased about this. In chapter 7, it says that the people who were sealed are now before the throne. A great multitude is before the throne. And John asks, who are they? And he says, these are those who have come out of the great tribulation. And then the NIV translates that the great tribulation. But every other time that word occurs, it just translates it trouble or suffering. But it's the same word. But that's sort of the holy line, the great tribulation. But the point is, this whole time between the comings is the great tribulation. Those people were in the great tribulation, and it's not, it rises and falls depending on where you live and the age in which you live. But basically, this whole time between the comings is the great tribulation. And John was already in the tribulation on his island. And the great one is just a way of referring to the whole time. Cindy, you had something about?
I think sometimes we think of trials and tribulations of things that get in the way of the kingdom, but it's not that. It's those things that are refining us and are allowing us to be conquerors with Christ, right?
Yeah. I think that's a remarkable line in verse 9. I'm your brother and your companion in the trouble and kingdom and endurance that are ours in Jesus. When you come to Jesus, that's what you get. That's the package. You get the kingdom, you get trouble, you get endurance. And so that's just how it is made to be. That's great.
Thanks for joining us. Our next episode will be on Revelation chapters 2 and 3.